As a teenager, I was a ardent communist. I mean, I had the Che Guevara t-shirt to prove it. And I wasn't like a completely ignorant communist as well. I mean, I learned about communism first in grade 9, where we studied different economic systems. We learned about free market capitalism, we learned about mixed economies, and we learned about centrally planned and communist countries. And we did learn about the devastation, the repression, the killings in many of these countries. And yet, there was something in my adolescence that communism really spoke to. I mean, there's kind of a fitting alignment between being an adolescent and being a communist. Right? I mean, communism says that the means of production should be distributed equally. And as an adolescent, you don't have access to many of the means of production. I mean, your parents have access to some of them, your teachers, everyone outside of you. So it kind of makes sense that you would want to rebel and upset the apple cart and figure it out. But I also did truly believe in the vision. I mean, that sense that every person should be entitled to a livelihood that was sustaining, that we could cooperatively do something together that didn't need to be kind of competitive. I remember having conversations with my mother about this. You know, most of the time she was, you know, very curious. She accompanied me in this moment in my life. She would ask me to play out scenarios to deepen my understanding. But sometimes when I would say things like, "I don't understand why anyone isn't a communist," or "You're morally, you know, you're a moral failure if you aren't a communist," or "I'm gonna be like this for the rest of my life," there was this expression that I saw in her face. You know, that ability to be curious was a little diminished. I recognized this face a few other times in my childhood. It usually came around those moments in which I was being arrogant or strident about myself or the world, claiming a sense of the way things are in only a way I think a teenager can fully. And usually, my mother would ask me a question along the lines of, "Do you think you're always going to feel this way?" And usually, my answer was yes. Like, I will always be a communist. I will never drink alcohol. I will always do yoga in the morning. Now, none of those things are true now. And I remember that face and that look, and the expression that usually came out was, "Never say never. Never say never." Thinking about those moments got me thinking about what it would be like if we were not able to change our minds. If, like, at one moment in your life, you got frozen, and from that point on, you couldn't change how you thought about the world. What would that be like? Would you want that? I mean, I can think back to those moments in my strident communist days, my youth, in which there's a certain pull in my heart that said, yeah, I would love to be back there, with that sense of deep conviction, that, you know, incisive clarity about the world. I wish I could go back to that. I've heard many Unitarian Universalists talk about kind of a nostalgia, a yearning for the faith they had as a child or growing up, one in which there were clear answers, a clear understanding of life after death, that there was, you know, black and white. So thinking about that question, what would it be like if you didn't change your mind? It can evoke this sense of, well, yearning for a time, but also probably revulsion, right? I mean, it's probably easy for us to think about people in our lives that we think haven't changed their mind enough. But also, we can probably look back to our days, whether it's yesterday or 2 decades ago, in which we held a perspective that we wouldn't want to hold on to now because it doesn't serve us, because it doesn't serve a wider movement of justice, because it doesn't align with a sense of truth that has been evolved. All of us go through such dynamic evolutions and changes throughout our lives, each of them intersecting with the other. We are this combination of all of our experiences in life. And sometimes these changes, these moments in which our minds shift, our lives change, can be deeply painful. Like we are going through a fire, burning away parts of ourselves so we can be reborn. And other times, they can feel joyful and liberating, like we're stepping into ourselves in a new way. Sometimes these moments of change are slow. We don't even see them happening until suddenly a mirror is shown and we see ourselves and hardly recognize us. And other times, it seems like everything can change in a moment, and what we thought was true or right is suddenly no longer true, no longer right, and we're caught in this space of gray. Now, it's not just us as individuals that live in these moments, this kind of evolution. It's our society as well, right? I mean, we have these moments in time that we can point to in our collective history in which the apple cart got upset. I mean, the most classic one is thinking about the Copernican Revolution, right? Back in that time when that dude, Copernicus, said something along the lines of, you know, the sun doesn't revolve around the earth. That actually it's the other way around. On the face of that, though, I mean, like, if someone told me that, I don't know if that would change very much in my life. I mean, it doesn't change what the sun does, just what I think about what the sun does. But of course, at the time, what the revolution was about was actually, it was about God. Because if the sun doesn't revolve around the earth, and that we revolve around the sun, and that our solar system isn't actually the center of our galaxy or universe at all, it brings into this question of our special relationship with God. Because if we are just one tiny planet in an ocean of billions of planets and stars, then is it truly believable that there is a God that has a special relationship with us? That's what that was really about. That's why the church got really upset, because that shift in belief upset the apple cart of what they thought was true and right. But there are so many of these moments that we have as a society. When our country dropped 2 atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, shifted fundamentally what we thought was possible, who we thought we were. The photo that was taken in 1968 of the Earth rising above the moon, which ushered in a new sense of what it meant to be human. For it was the first time that we saw this beautiful orb that is our home without these divisions of countries or economic systems. That picture is credited with bolstering an environmentalist movement, sought to care and protect this earth. But all of these moments in which everything seems to shift, where what was true before is no longer, all of this life in the gray reveals something about truth, which is that it is deeply slippery. That it seems to change and move. That it's not static. It's not even objective. But it's slippery. And in fact, sometimes the more we want to grasp onto it, the harder it is. If you've ever tried to really grasp onto a bar of soap, the more force you apply, the faster it flies away. There's a story that's probably apocryphal about the physicist Albert Einstein. He's teaching a course, graduate school in Princeton, and he's administering the final exam. And so he passes the exam to the teaching assistant, who's going to, you know, pass them out. And the teaching assistant looks at it and says, "Huh, are these the same questions that you asked last year?" And Einstein said, "Yes, yes, they are." And the teaching assistant, like, looked a little bit quizzical and was like, "Is that really a good idea? I mean, couldn't they just, like, figure out the answers from other people?" Like, it wasn't settling with him. And Einstein said, "Yes, they are the same questions, but the answers are different." Yeah. And what he was pointing to is that just even within that year, our conceptions of physics had so fundamentally shifted that the way you would respond to the first question last year would be different than how you would understand it now. I mean, that's what Einstein did to the whole conception of physics. It was my worst subject, so I'm not going to explain to you what he did, but I heard that he really changed things. But there are probably people in our lives who have done that for us, or experiences, or moments, in which the answers that we would give in 1 year no longer answer the questions when we come a year later. All that you touch, you change. The African-American writer, science fictionist, Octavia Butler writes, "All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change." This change thing, this life in the gray, is actually the core of our liberal religious faith. We call ours a liberal faith, not because it is sometimes associated with liberal politics. But in fact, we call our faith a liberal faith because of how it understands and relates to truth. For you can be a political conservative and a religious liberal. The connection between liberal politics and liberal religion is there because of the people who make up the institutions, not an inherent conception within the ideologies. James Luther Adams was a Unitarian minister and ethicist in the 20th century. He studied the rise of authoritarianism in Europe, in Nazi Germany, and spoke very beautifully about the core of what liberal religion is. And here's how I summarize what he said. The core of religious liberalism is, we don't know much, we can know more, and it will change. That we don't know much, that we can know more, and that it will change. And this is a very different conception of truth than a non-liberal faith. Because a non-liberal faith, the conception that truth might change, not so good. What these three tenets instill in our liberal faith is a deep and abiding curiosity, because it tells us that truth continues to be revealed. It's why Unitarians and Universalists have never fought the advances of science as they revealed new truths about our world, because we didn't think it was antithetical to our project as liberal religious people. We were the first people to take the theory of evolution and try to bring it into a context of a faith community. We didn't fight it. We actually thought it was cool that we might come from blue-green algae. We thought it might actually give us more insight into what it means to be human. The idea that truth continues to be revealed means that there wasn't just one moment in history when some ultimate being revealed ultimate truth through a prophet or through an experience. Truth continuing to be revealed means that our experiences of life are valid fodder for understanding. That your life, that my life, that our life together, our collective ways of trying to understand through the works of spirituality, science, the humanities, even our bodies, are valid ways of understanding ultimate truth. But it also, this conception of religious liberalism, has on the other side of curiosity a deep humility. A humility that says that our piece of the truth is just that, a piece. That we are just a piece of a larger puzzle. And in fact, what Luther Adams would assert is that the ultimate truth is unknowable. He says, liberalism has no monopoly upon the fount of life. Indeed, the clearest springs may be so far up in the mountains that our little systems and labels would appear artificial there, if not actually impertinent. The transcendent belongs to no party. It perennially eludes domestication. I love that. This idea that truth is beyond, that we're never going to be able to encapsulate it, completely understand it, grasp it in its totality. That's a humility piece, which goes with the curiosity. It says, I have a piece of the truth, and so do you, and together we can understand a little bit more, but we're never going to understand it all, which means that I might be wrong, and that you might be wrong, and that's okay. But the other part of that, curiosity and humility, is that liberalism itself asserts that no part of our beliefs, no part of our practices, no part of our liberal faith is beyond self-criticism, is beyond re-examination. Whereas in other faiths, there are certain sacred parts in which if you question that, you question the fundamental aspects of who they are. For our faith, we hold that no part of it is beyond re-examination. No part of it should be subject to idolization. That in fact, there is a renewal that happens when we question that which we thought was set. Which means that liberalism isn't in fact its beliefs, its practices. Liberalism is a process, a continual commitment to life in process, living in the gray, of pushing the veil back to understand, realize how much you don't, realize that you're wrong, get some other people to come along and try again. It's the movement that is what a liberal faith is. So have any of you ever tried to move codfish anywhere? Well, apparently, when you catch a codfish and you kill it, it very quickly becomes like not very tasty if you put it on ice. Like it doesn't keep its real vigor. And so fisher people were really struggling with this because people didn't want to eat cod for a while because it didn't really keep its tenacity. It kind of became mushy. So what they found was that they first tried just getting bunches of tanks and actually having live codfish transported around so that, you know, people could have it killed closer to its, eat it closer to its kill date. I'm a vegetarian, so that might have been insensitive, but it's true. What they found is that actually the fish kind of just got all mushy too because they didn't really move around in their tanks. So one ingenious fisher person thought, what would happen if we put a catfish in the tank? Catfishes and codfish don't get along. And so as they went on their journeys, they would move around vigorously in the tanks, keeping them active, so that when we got to eat them, they tasted good. Self-criticism and re-examination is the catfish, right? That keeps us moving, keeps us supple. All of this to say that religious liberals, we have not always done the best job of this. And I said that we were some of the first to integrate religious evolution into our belief system. Well, that actually led many of us to think that it was our religious duty to practice eugenics, the process of trying to alter who got to procreate as humans, to weed out undesirable traits and people. Many of our ancestors, Unitarians and Universalists, supported these movements to reduce the undesirable nature of certain people, especially people with disabilities. That's part of us. We've also, for much of the time, thought that we were totally rational, benevolent beings. Gretchen's going to preach on that next week, so you can come back to hear about that. We've also thought for many time that we are in a linear upward trajectory towards more truth and more justice. Something we are re-examining. That's why liberalism is a process, not a destination. The critics of liberalism often say that we are kind of full of arrogance and hubris and pride, because who are we to say that we have a piece of the truth? That's what gets leveled at us. Who are you to say that you have a piece of the truth? And James Woods Adams had this great comeback. He said, it's actually the height of hubris for any human to claim the ability to recognize infallibility. What he means by that is, isn't it more arrogant, more prideful, more hubristic for someone to say, this belief is the only truth, versus our claim, which is we only have a piece of it? Critics of liberalism have also asserted that because we draw from so many sources, from science, from our lives, from our bodies, from our histories, that we don't have something to stand on because we come from so many places. I feel like that is the more valid critique of our work. And for liberalism to mean something, it must figure out how to take a stand, knowing that it will be provisional. For that is the core of the liberal faith. It's not its expression in any moment, but this dynamic process of living, not being paralyzed in the gray, in the provisional, but embracing it with curiosity and humility. That way, liberalism dies and is reborn, just like we are in our lives, taking our experiences and what we thought to be true and mixing them together in new and more dynamic ways. That is how we remain vital. So recently, there's been a rise in antibiotic-resistant diseases, infections. You heard about this? These so-called superbugs, these bacterial strains that infect us that we don't have drugs that can actually treat them. I mean, it was a miracle, an absolute miracle, when we found antibiotics for the first time. I mean, suddenly all of these terrible afflictions we could cure. But what they found very soon after, even penicillin was introduced, that first antibiotic, was that it only took about 11 months before some of the strains that it was used to cure started to develop a resistance to it. They no longer could be cured by it, which created this kind of cycle that you'd iterate the drug a little bit, release it in the market, and 11 months later, it would have immunity. And so you'd have to do that again and again, caught in this cycle of trying to contain. And we're getting to the place that we've done this so many times that some of these bacterial infections are resistant to almost every drug that we have. Which is why it was so curious when in the United Kingdom, a scholar of Anglo-Saxon history teamed up with a microbiologist and found an antibiotic that cured MRSA. Here's the story. So Dr. Christina Lee and Dr. Freya Harrison, working in the United Kingdom, both had a fascination with Anglo-Saxon history. And they met each other at a book club. And they both were interested in history and microbiology, and so they decided to do a little experiment. They decided to look into a 9th century text, this Bald's Leech book, this book of healing potions. And they decided that they were going to try to make one of the remedies. They picked the one that was called the best medicine, because why not? It was supposed to cure a lump in the eye, probably a sty. And so they assembled their ingredients, onion, garlic, parts of a cow's stomach. They mixed it together in a brass and copper pot. They let it sit on the counter for 9 days. It smelled great. They brought it into the lab and they put it on a petri dish that had some staph infection, some of this bacteria. They came back the next day and 90% of the bacteria was dead. So they were like, we must have done something wrong. So they tried it again. They followed the same instructions. They gathered their cow bladder and all of that stuff, mixed it together, let it set for 90 days. But this time they sent it to their colleague who put it on MRSA, which is this drug-resistant staph infection. And the next day they came back, 90% of it was gone. What they had found, what they had stumbled into, was the fact that this remedy, which seems kind of ridiculous to us, onions, garlic, cow bladder, I mean, most of us could actually source those ingredients if we really wanted to, was actually effective in treating something that modern pharmacology couldn't. But what probably happened is that as this leech book's remedies started to work, the bacteria would evolve themselves. And so it probably wasn't effective for very long either. But over the centuries, the immunity within the bacteria wore off. So now it was susceptible again to this cure. What I love about this kind of weird anecdote is what it tells us about life. That life is a constant experiment and process. That to be effective, we can't just set something and expect everything else to stay the same. We have to be in this process of trial and error, of understanding that everything that was in the past is not useless or to be disregarded just because we're here in the present looking to the future. That actually truth is more complex, and that these things come in circles and waves, and we must be open to it. The fact is, truth may be provisional at best for us. We may have to live our lives in the gray. But our lives are not provisional. They're not approximate. They're what we have. The core of liberal religion says that a static truth stagnates. That a static truth stagnates. And so our work is to live in the process of re-examining. One of my friends tells a story about her rabbi. She asked her rabbi, like, what does humility mean? And her rabbi responded, humility is taking up just the right amount of space. Not shrinking to take up none, not claiming it all, taking up the right amount of space. So as we humans try to figure out how to live life in the gray, our work is to be curious and to be humble, to not shrink away from bringing our truth and our person to the table, but also not to think that we won't be wrong. Amen.